Okay. If I can have everyone's attention, please. Thank you all for coming. My name is Rabbi Mordechai Fleischer, and in addition to being the presenter today, I will also be moderating the session. So if you don't like me as a moderator, perhaps I'll do better as the presenter. Thank you all for coming once again. Welcome to the first class of the Kollel's 14th year of Torah for Tycoons. And we'd like to thank the Harry H. Baron Trust and Rabbi Zev Baron for their generous sponsorship of this program over the last 13 and now the 14th year as we begin our 14th season of this wonderful program. I'm sure some of you may have noticed over the last number of months that this program has evolved beyond just tycoon types of discussions to other relevant topics. Certainly today's discussion, your battles, rules of warfare engagement, is a subject which unfortunately right now is very much on the world stage with all the international issues that are going on in so many parts of the world. And so I hope that everyone will enjoy and leave this class more informed about how the Torah views these ideas. Just a couple of short announcements before we begin. On the tables, you can see some of the programs that the Kollel is offering. Rosh Hashanah is around the corner. It's in 2 weeks from tonight, actually, is Rosh Hashanah, and the Kollel is offering its Rosh Hashanah Simanim Symbolic Foods Platter, as it has for the last number of years. We are offering it again this year. You could see the flyer over there right now or after the class if you'd like. And that is a number of different items for the various symbolic foods that are customarily eaten on Rosh Hashanah. In addition, the Kollel's annual donor appreciation event will take place on Monday, September 25th. If you'd like more information about that, please speak to myself or any of the other Kollel rabbis here after the class. Lastly, you can hear today's class that, as Captain Stitzer points out to me, will need clearance from the higher-ups. What do you call them?
The Public Affairs Office.
The Public Affairs Office. We'll need clearance, but we do hope to have that recording on the website in the coming days after today's class. And other past classes are available on the Kollel's website, denverkollel.org, along with other recordings and programs of classes. And with that, I will introduce Captain Chaim Shmuel Stitzer of the United States Air Force to present on the rules of warfare engagement.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi Fleischer. Good afternoon. You can see, unfortunately, we had some technical issues getting the slides to present, but you should all have a paper copy in front of you. So much like those books on tape you would listen to as a kid, when you hear this sound, you know it's time to turn the page. As Rabbi Fleischer said, my name is Chaim Shmuel Stitzer. I am a cyberspace operations officer over at Buckley Air Force Base, a bit east of here in Aurora. Now, if you'll go to the first slide, or second slide, as it'll be. Before we begin, I do need to make a couple of disclaimers, maybe make a few things clear. You can read the full the disclaimer on the slide, but basically the two main points is that, first of all, I am not here in any official capacity as an Air Force officer. I am here as myself, and nothing that I say here today, any opinions or any statements that I say, nothing should be construed as reflecting the opinions of the United States government or any agency or department therein. Anything I say is to me and me alone. The second one is that I am not a lawyer, military or otherwise, so nothing here should be seen as actual legal advice. These slides are from the 460th Space Wing's legal office, and I am versed in these slides and can answer some basic questions. However, anything that goes into more depth to that is more technical, I will have to direct you either to the 460th Space Wing's Public Affairs Office or Legal Office. That being said, if you'll flip over, today we're going to be talking about the law of armed conflict and various subsections of that. Don't worry about the acronyms. We'll decipher those as we get to them. So next slide. So first, the law of armed conflict, or more commonly known as LOAC, is a general overarching international law that basically discusses how we can legally wage war. It's derived from various different conventions and treaties, the well-known Geneva Conventions, but some other less known ones as well. And I'm not going to read each particular point there, but basically it exists because although we are engaged in war, which is of course a fairly violent event, we still want to make sure that it is not that there is still some structure and that people who are not who are not engaged in conflict shouldn't be put endangered because of it. And we also want to try to keep the conflict where it belongs, not to have it spill over either to neighboring countries or even just to neighboring cities and towns that may not have been involved. And this will mean that when the conflict comes to an end, it'll be a lot easier to restore peace if you haven't gone out and just done whatever you wanted. So we do have a body of law that we follow as a United States Airman, and this of course does apply to all of the branches, but this is an Air Force brief. So as an airman, of course, we have responsibility to keep these laws, and for example, as an officer, it would be my responsibility to make sure that my troops would keep the law. And then just to kind of get to some of those acronyms on the last bullet there, if any airman, regardless of rank, were to see something going on, then they would report that to their chain of command, meaning their supervisor, their commander, something like that. The IG is the Inspector General, which is the overarching body that's outside of the chain that can investigate anything. The Judge Advocate General, which is the legal office. The Office of Special Investigations, which is the Air Force's investigative division, kind of like the Air Force's FBI, if you will. And HC is a symbol which means chaplains. You can speak to your chaplain as well if you were to see any violation of LOAC. Next slide. So what exactly is it? Well, so the first is this idea of we are conducting a military operation in order to secure a military objective, to accomplish a mission, whatever the case may be. So we need to make sure that's what we're doing, and no more. We also want to make sure, again, like I said, that people who should not be affected by the conflict are not affected by the conflict. However, that also goes into the next area, which is this distinction, which means that if it's the other party's responsibility also to ensure that these things are labeled. So for example, if you use a house of worship as a munition storing facility, well, you have now broken that distinction. And instead of saying, okay, this is a religious building, it is not part of this conflict, you have now made it part of the conflict, and it would now be a legal target as well. And the last element is that proportionality, which is, I think this is kind of a big one, is civilian casualties. We do not target civilians. However, civilian casualties are a reality of war. Things do happen. We try to limit it. We try to avoid it. However, it's not 100% avoidable. And therefore, combatant commanders have to make that decision of whatever objective we're trying to accomplish, whether it's we want to take out this certain building, we want to take this certain city, is it worth the civilian casualties that we will probably cause? Again, not intentionally, but just as a result of what we're doing. And so what goes into that, and I do want to get to that last bullet, says what do you strike with? So when do you say, well, this is so important, we went to go nuclear in quotes, and then nuclear not in quotes, nuclear in quotes, meaning, you know, this is a high priority target. This is the leader of the opposition. This is, if we can take out this military headquarters, they'll be done. then we say, okay, just go do it, take care of it, because if we get rid of this, the conflict will be over, and that will avoid any further conflict. Versus saying, well, let's be careful. Let's use only this type of munition, which has this kind of range, versus using a larger munition, which causes more damage but can affect a larger range. And then of course, the new nuclear option itself, which of course is a decision made above the military services, but the national decision makers will take LOAC into consideration when they are making that decision. Next slide. The next one is humanity, the idea of unnecessary suffering. This again goes back to what is being used to achieve a military objective and accomplish the mission, and when are we going too far and saying, well, no, this is no longer about accomplishing the mission, this is just about causing harm and things that just doesn't help anybody. So for example, you see that there are lawful weapons that we are allowed to employ, as well as unlawful weapons, and you can see examples there on the slide. But there are things that we have agreed again through LOAC, through these treaties, that we will not use these weapons for whatever reasons. And again, just because a weapon is lawful does not mean that it can be used in any situation. Using a bomb that has a radius of five miles to take out a house that's 100 square feet, that might be a legal weapon to use in other instances. It would not be legal here. And then chivalry, kind of that idea of you can wage war without misleading. So for example, it's perfectly okay to camouflage yourself and ambush an enemy force, but for example, to wave the white flag and say I surrender, and then when they come to then go and ambush them, that is no longer lawful warfare. That is an unlawful use of deception, as would be again putting a red cross onto an ambulance and then using that as a troop carrier. Again, that would be abusing the LOAC laws that we're trying to use to keep things controlled, and then using that to your advantage would be a violation of LOAC. Next slide. So now we get to the actual people, the combatants themselves. Three categories, as you can see: lawful combatants, someone like myself, who is part of the armed forces and who do engage in wartime acts, and we are allowed by international law by LOAC to do so. You then have non-combatants, which besides for civilians, you see are also medical personnel, including military medical personnel. Chaplains, but again, but not chaplain's assistants. A chaplain assistant is actually the chaplain's bodyguard, so they are a lawful combatant. And then prisoners of war are also included in this. So if someone is captured and becomes a POW, a prisoner of war, they are now taken out of the status of lawful combatant. They are now non-combatants, and they are now captured, but they are. The enemy is not allowed to go and just say, well, you're an enemy soldier, so we're just going to exterminate. You cannot do that to POWs. But then you have unlawful combatants, which is kind of that area where, say, a civilian were to go and pick up arms. Well, they have now broken international law because they are not lawful combatants. Because they have engaged in combat, they are no longer protected. So a civilian can't get up and start shooting at the enemy and then complain when they start shooting back. That's basically what that says. And finally, last slide. I said that I deciphered these when we got to them. Rules of engagement, status of forces agreement, and general order one. Rules of engagement are under that's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff instruction. So this is a regulation and a directive that comes from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. 3121.01, which of course first says that besides for key keeping LOAC, in all instances there are also rules of engagement. A rule of engagement, and this is the big difference between the two, is that the law of armed conflict applies to everything. Rules of engagement are conflict specific. So aside from the general law of armed conflict that we just spoke about, every conflict will have its own rules of engagement for different specific nuances in that specific conflict. Now there's the standing rule of engagement, which says that you have inherent right of self-defense. That's a very important point, which means that regardless of anything else, we're told, oh, be careful, don't use force in this situation, don't use force or worse than that situation. But if you come under attack, you always have the inherent right to self-defense. But then there will be something that says, well, for example, if an enemy combatant is injured, are you able to then go ahead and kill them, or do you have to stand back? And many other such things that will be specific for every region or every conflict, and these are given by the combatant commanders. And then the last one, the rules for use of force. So for example, you have right now you have the Texas National Guard out there helping people in Houston. That's not a combat situation, obviously, but if some relief truck starts getting mobbed and they're afraid that they are in danger, they have rules of use of force of what can they do, what can't they do, when. The status of forces agreement is something that we get involved in. It's not about combat specifically, but it is something that, say we have a base in Turkey or Germany. These are rules these are agreements that we have with those host countries to say things like, if a troop goes off base and commits a crime, are they prosecuted by the host country's laws, or are they prosecuted by the military's laws? And it'll also cover other things as well. You can see the list there on the slide. And then the last thing I want to mention is General Order 1. It's something that comes from the combatant commander, usually a general with several stars, who's in charge of that entire area of conflict. And they say, okay, you're going to this area. For example, you're going to Iraq. That's a country that's very heavily Muslim. Don't bring alcohol. Don't gamble. Different things like that. Can you hunt in these areas? So General Order 1 will be something that will say, here's what you can do. Here's what you can't. And if you don't follow that rule, that is prosecutable under Article 92 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So it is an enforceable order. So that, in a very small nutshell, is an overview of the United States' stance on conflict and the rules of war and other such things. And I'd now like to turn over to Reverend Fleischer.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions before I start talking? Once I start talking, I don't stop so fast. So,
yes. Yeah.
I just want to mention a couple of quick things. There's things that you hear about nowadays. I just want to confirm, if I remember right, that the terrorists are really unlawful combatants or something like that. I just want to clarify whether that's correct. They don't wear uniforms like a regular army. And the other thing is the thing about human shields. I heard the Israeli army, they have, for instance, they come across a situation where the enemies they purposely go where they have civilians to be human shields, and whether that's a clear cut situation, how that's dealt with.
So to answer the first point, and again, this is not authoritative. I'm not a lawyer, but to the best of my knowledge, as I understand it, you're correct. A terrorist who is not part of a standing military force is considered a civilian and is therefore an unlawful combatant. Yes. Now, as far as human shields, I would say that that's probably something that would go directly into the purview of the rules of engagement of what to do in that case. I don't think there's a standing law within LOAC that says if a human shield is employed, you will or will not do this or that. I would say that would probably be a conflict-specific rule engagement.
Is a civilian engaged in self-defense considered a non-lawful combatant? we invade Iraq, Iraqi farmer shoots at us as we approach his farm. Is he a non-lawful combatant or is he lawful?
That sounds like something that would be very case-specific. There's a very big difference between approaching his farm to kill him versus going by, but invading. So I think there exactly is a distinctive point. It is not his job to defend his country. He is not a combatant. That is the job of the Iraqi army. So in that case, if that's what it was, then yes, it would be an unlawful combatant. And so.
A question and just one quick comment. It's very hard, I know, to wage war and to conduct a war when only one side is observant of these laws. But anyway, that's just the way it is, unfortunately, especially today. But for instance, when children were used, I know they were in Vietnam, as explosive devices, God forbid. But if you knew that child had a device, or maybe even a 7, 8-year-old child who'd been trained from birth to hate the individuals that they're at, the movie The Sniper, of course, comes to my mind in Iraq, where Chris had to make a decision whether that young boy was a combatant to take him out. So how does, when it's a small child like it was in Vietnam, and I'm sure some in Iraq, did they then become a combatant even though they're children?
So that is a very nuanced case and a very, very, you know, difficult case. And again, I would refer you to those agencies for a specific, but again, just from my understanding, I think that inherent right of self-defense still applies. So if anyone of any age is coming to harm you, and there's no question about that, I would think, you know, personally, I would think that that inherent right to self-defense would still allow you to engage, because it's your life or theirs.
That
is in the slide. Your unit's inherent right to self-defense. But again, I would think that would if we were somewhere where that was being done, I would think that would be covered by a rule of engagements that they were put down for that conflict. Yeah.
It seems to me that there may be a fine line between what is chivalrous and what is not chivalrous in terms of deceptive tactics, where one might appear that you look like you're cheating when in fact you're not. So deception is part of good warfare, I would think, and there has to be some sort of accountability for that being proper fighting behavior.
Yeah. So I think the key, and I apologize if I didn't make this clear. I think the key difference there is that the unlawful part is using an element of LOAC as a deception, right? So the idea of we will not bomb an ambulance, you then go and use an ambulance because you know we're not going to bomb it. That's different. The example given is if there are soldiers, you know, paratroopers who are jumping out of a plane, you have every right to try to shoot them down. But if a pilot ejects from a shot down plane, then you cannot shoot because they are considered a prisoner of war. So there's those kinds of things where, I mean, you know, everyone, you know, you use deception. You set up false signs, or you can, you know, use camouflage. But again, using those elements and saying, well, I know that they're not going to shoot someone waving the white flag, not because of any strategy, but because that's the law that we follow of not shooting someone who's waving a white flag. Therefore, I'm going to wave a white flag and then ambush them. That would be the unlawful part. Yes, sir.
Who creates these rules? These international rules.
So that's and again I kind of skimmed over that, but it's they come out of conventions, Geneva conventions, Hague conventions.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you very much, Captain Stitzer. And so now, I guess I have my work cut out for me. One disclaimer before I start: I am here in my individual capacity only. Nothing said during this presentation. I do want to point out I am far from an expert, certainly in the halacha of military law. I did research and look into the different parts of this, some of the questions that come up, and certainly in the state of Israel, which has a standing army, there are many responses written over the last, I guess one could say, 75 to 100 years, probably over the last 75 years, regarding the ethical issues that come up in the Israeli Defense Forces, in terms of what protocols they should follow, and it's not just theoretical, because even if the Israeli Defense Forces, and I'm not familiar whether they necessarily follow halacha all the time or not, but certainly there are many religious soldiers who need to know what to do and how to approach things. Unfortunately, these questions come up, and certainly. In terms of the IDF itself and the challenges they face on the world stage because of the challenges in terms of terrorists and armies or armies of terrorists or however you want to define them, that itself, as was mentioned, is a challenge, and the unfortunate bias that is often encountered on the world stage in terms of how they would treat the Israeli Defense Forces versus armies of terrorists, or again, however you would like to define those individuals, certainly they face many of these kinds of challenges that some of you have brought up, some that Captain Stitzer raised. What I would like to try to do is discuss it in a more general sense, and in terms of nuanced questions, we could try to explore some of them, but certainly to get into the nitty-gritty of some of the very difficult issues that arise, I don't know that we'll have clear answers, and as Captain Stitzer said, many of them are on a case-by-case basis. The first question we think we have to ask in this conversation is how does the Torah view war? Okay, is there a concept? Certainly, the Torah talks about war extensively in many places. But the question is there a halachic basis? Is there a Torah basis for one nation to engage in war with another nation? And is there a halachic basis to allow an army to just go ahead and maim and murder members of another nation for any reason whatsoever? Okay, is there any halachic basis for that? So the first thing that may come to mind, if for those who have a familiarity with different areas of Jewish law, is a law known as a rodef. A rodef, if you look at source number one, literally means a pursuer. There's a law in the Torah that one who these are the ones who are saved with their lives, meaning there is permission to kill an individual who is engaged or in attempting to perpetrate certain crimes, and very few where it's permitted to murder the person to stop him. But one of them is one who's pursuing his friend, some friend, to kill him. Okay? So if person A is running after person B with a gun, trying to shoot him, so then person B is allowed to kill person A to save himself. Not only that, but any bystander has not only the right but the obligation to stop the pursuer from carrying out his nefarious plans from murdering the other person. Okay? Now, seemingly one can make an argument that in wartime, once the war has begun, if there is an army, if Army A is fighting against Army B, so then the members of Army A have the right to kill members of Army B because it's kill or be killed. If a soldier from Army A does not engage in the war and fire back, then he's going to end up being killed himself, and therefore he would have a right to kill the other soldier from the opposing army. This approach, we could just stop here and everyone could just go home, but if we stop at this, obviously there are numerous problems that would come up. Problem number one is, how did the war start in the first place? Let's just assume that both armies are Torah-observant armies. So they came to the rabbi before and said, "Rabbi, we've got this fight going on. What's going on?" "Well, that passage in Talmud got out of hand, you know." So, you know, but in all seriousness, let's just assume for a moment we have a question posed to a rabbi. Are two armies allowed to engage in fighting over a territorial dispute, over whatever it may be? Are they allowed to engage in warfare? To initially start the war, seemingly, this wouldn't help. This is once the war is already on, one would have a right to defend oneself. Okay, that's one issue. Issue number two is that this is not a carte blanche permission to just go ahead and murder anyone who is pursuing someone else to take his or her life. Rather, it's use the means necessary to stop that person's crime from taking place. So, person A wants to kill person B. And you can stop person A by just disarming him, by shooting him in the foot, whatever else, by putting up a roadblock, whatever it may be. Then you don't have the right to go ahead and kill him if you can stop him from taking someone else's life by some other means. Okay? So if diplomacy would be effective, I'm not getting involved in that debate right now, but let's just say diplomacy would be effective. Let us say that disarming them would be effective. Let us say that you can disarm the person by just shooting his hand off and he can't shoot anymore, or the foot and so on. You wouldn't have the right to murder the person. Now, obviously, in the heat of battle, you can't expect the person to start figuring out, let's see, can I shoot him in the foot or just knock his gun out of his hand? That's not necessarily something which is relevant. But going back to the case of the sniper that you mentioned earlier, if this sniper is good enough, and I'm assuming if it was a movie made out of him, he is, then why kill the person? Just shoot the guns out of their hands or maim them or disarm them. It certainly would not be enough to cover the entire spectrum of war to say, oh, there's a rule in the Torah called rodef, a pursuer, and that validates whatever goes on during wartime. It certainly would fall very short. It does become relevant in certain specific cases, as we'll try to talk about. For example, let us go back to the case of the human shield or of the child who is inducted into the army. And you talk about a child who's, you know, trained to hate and to fight from youth. If I understand correctly, in parts of the world, armies comprise of kids who are dragged off when they're 7, 8, 9 years old into army camps. They're trained and they're on that battlefield when they're 11, 12 years old. You know, it's tragic. It's a reality. So this child may have been brainwashed from the point when he was a little child, but the fact of the matter is he's holding a gun and he wants to kill the other soldier. So would that give him the status of a rodef, of a pursuer? Let's take that a step further. Let's talk about the human shield situation. Or let's talk about a little kid who doesn't know any better, who's booby-trapped, okay, with explosives, and it just says, go take a walk over there. Okay, and the kid doesn't even know any better. He has no clue what he's doing. It's not even that he's consciously making a decision. Okay, and unfortunately this has gone on. What is the law? It's not a simple matter. In source number two, there's a fascinating discussion about one who is pursuing his fellow by inciting a snake or something similar. This is the classic case in the Talmud of indirect murder. I'm not going to shoot anyone. I will simply take a cobra and send it against the other person. Those who are familiar with the Sherlock Holmes case, the speckled band, anyone? No one. Okay. Go read it, and then you'll come back to me and say, wow, Rabbi Fleischer, that was a great application. Okay, so, and in any event, if you incite a snake to go bite someone else and thereby murder the person, okay, according to the letter of the law, you are not liable to the death penalty. You're not winning, the Nice Guy of the Year award. Let's make that very clear. But you're not liable to the death penalty because you have not committed an act of murder. You have caused a murder to occur indirectly. There's a lot of discussion in the Talmud where you draw the line between causative and direct. That's not our discussion right now. Okay? But, says the Or Sameach was a 19th, early 20th century Torah authority, Rabbi Meir Simcha of the city of Dvinsk, in Western Russia. And he makes this point that something for which he would be exempt were he to actually cause death. But because right now his intent is to murder another person, he is certainly given to save him with his life, for the intent is to save the life. What is the difference if he wants to kill him in a way that will exempt him from the death penalty in court? What Rabbi Meir Simcha, the Or Sameach, is making a point over here is that the idea of killing a rodef, the pursuer, is not you're a bad guy, you're trying to kill someone, therefore let's kill you. It's someone else's life is in danger. And because you are the one causing that danger, so therefore, your life becomes forfeit. The pursuer's life becomes forfeit because he is the source of a danger to another life. And in order to save the life of the pursuee, the person being hunted down, therefore is the pursuer's life has in essence forfeited his life in order to save the second life. Okay, that is where the idea comes from, and that's why if you can save the life without killing the pursuer, you have to do so, because it's not a carte blanche permission to kill him. It's just save the second life. But in order to do that, if need be, you can kill the first person. So that's even if he's causing it. So therefore, one can make the argument, and some have made the argument, that if you have civilians who are deliberately housing terrorists, knowingly housing terrorists, so that they are now party to these problems, okay? If they are willingly being booby-trapped, willingly luring soldiers into booby-trapped homes, et cetera, some would argue that that makes those individuals a rodef as well. Okay, where you drew the line, is that called causing a murder or not? There's a lot of talk about that, but the argument could be made that a civilian who is doing things which are not directly combative, as you call it, but as unfortunately happened, where you have a civilian who will lure soldiers into a home and the home is booby-trapped, or something of that effect, one can make the argument that that person is a pursuer. Okay, the problem, again, with this approach is that it's only if the pursuer is deliberate. Once the pursuer is not deliberately becoming the pursuer, if there's a human shield, and that human shield is a threat to the soldiers' lives, who would, you know, now shoot the other soldiers, but the other soldiers of Army B are using human shields. So yes, the human shields may be posing a threat to the lives of soldiers of Army A, but they're not doing it on purpose. If it's not deliberate, then you lose that right. Then their life, his or her life, is not forfeit. The classic case where this comes up is if you have a woman in childbirth. You have a woman in childbirth. So once the baby begins to emerge from the mother and the baby begins to be born, that is a full-fledged human life. And then even if that baby is a threat to the mother's life, you cannot take the baby's life anymore because the baby is regarded as being born. It's now a full-fledged human. You cannot take the life of the child to save the mother. As long as the child is still inside the mother, that becomes a whole different discussion. It is a human life, but not at the same level as a human already living. This is a totally separate discussion, which I should point out we're hoping to have a class on sometime in the future on this. But certainly it is regarded as a life, but not at the same level. And therefore, halacha states that the baby's life, the fetus's life, may be terminated in order to save the mother. But once the child emerges, okay, the birth is still taking place, you can't touch the child anymore. Because it's a human life versus a human life. And the Talmud expresses the following idea. Who says your blood is redder than the other person's blood? That's the expression used by the Talmud, which says you cannot take someone else's life to save your life or anyone else's life. Okay, you cannot perform an action of taking a life to save your life. So therefore, if you have a human shield, an individual who is forced to become a human shield, these terrorists took a person and tied him to the tank, which again, unfortunately, tragically happens. This person has no interest in being tied to that tank. Okay, let's just assume that. Can you go ahead and blow up the tank with that person? It's not a simple matter at all if we're just talking about the rules of a pursuer, because this person is not deliberately trying to cause you problems. They've been forced into it. And so therefore, the ideas of pursuer, while fascinating and having limited applications in wartime, would not suffice for our discussion of warfare. Okay, which brings us to source number three, and this is a fascinating source over here, from the Hemek Dover. Hemek Dover was written by Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, a great 19th century Torah authority leader. He was the head of the Voloshin Yeshiva in Russia, and he wrote a commentary on the Torah where he says, on the verse in Parshas Noach, after the flood, so Noah and his family emerge from the ark, and God lays down a few rules for the humanity version 2. Okay? So after God wipes the entire world, Noah emerges, God says, we're starting again. We're going to try this again. And here's a few rules. And God lays down some of the rules of murder to Noah over there. And one of the things that God says is that if one, if a person kills his brother, so God says, I will demand his life from the hand of his brother. Now that language, brother, is instructive, says Rabbi Berlin. He says, when is a person punished for murder? At a time when it's proper to conduct oneself with brotherhood. Whereas during wartime, to paraphrase the famous verse, a time to hate, paraphrasing that verse in Koheles, in Ecclesiastes. Yes? Ecclesiastes. Thank you. I'll say that three times fast later. Then it is a time to kill, and there is no punishment for this at all, for this is how the world was set up. So a fascinating idea put forth by the Netziv, by Rabbi Berlin, that there's an idea called warfare. And God specifically worded his statement to Noah as, I will demand his blood from the hand of his brother. That when it's peacetime, that's when there's a strict prohibition against murder. But during wartime, and war is part and parcel of how the world runs, that's just the reality. Okay, and God set up the world in such a way that allows for the opportunity for war. Okay, during wartime, which is defined as a time to hate, it's not a time of brotherhood, the prohibition against murder within the confines of the war, obviously, are taken away. You don't have that prohibition in place. And here, really, you have a major source for the idea of warfare and for the permission to kill enemy combatants, because this is a war. And there's no prohibition of murder, says the Netziv, during wartime. Okay? To take this idea a step further, in source number four, we have a thought from the full title, the Chedushi Agriz al Torah. This is from a man known as the Brisker Rav, Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik. He was the rabbi of the town of Brest-Litovsk in pre-World War II Europe. He immigrated to Israel. He was one of the eminent major Torah authorities of the fledgling Jewish community in the early years of the State of Israel. Okay, major, major authority. And he, in his commentary on the Torah, makes the following point. He asks the following question. He says, one second. How does the Torah have this whole idea of going to war in the first place? We know that in the Torah, the sanctity of life is of paramount importance. So there are certain cases where a person is obligated to go to war. Okay, the Torah says you have to go to war. What if the soldier says, I'm sorry, but I know there's a mitzvah in the Torah to go to war, but one is not obligated to give one's life for performance of a mitzvah, save for the three cardinal sins, idolatry, certain immoral relationships, and murder. And over here, going to war doesn't fall under any of those three. I'm going home, because I don't have to perform a mitzvah at risk to my life. This is the question that is raised. And he says that war by definition involves risk to life, and therefore the idea that we are concerned about danger to life does not apply during wartime. He says these are from the laws of war. In other words, that's the nature. For we go even to an optional war. There are situations where a king may lead the Jewish people out to war, even if it's not commanded by God. Situations, again, I'm not getting involved. That's a lengthy discussion unto itself. Even though there's no mitzvah. There's not even a mitzvah. And yet the Torah lays down the rules of warfare and of conduct of soldiers and who has to go out to battle and so on during wartime. Danger to life, says the Brisker Rav. That idea of danger to life is not relevant during a war, because war by definition involves risk to life. And you can't invoke the Torah's importance attached to preserving human life during wartime. Okay? So this really is taking the previous source a step further, that not only is the prohibition against murder abrogated during a wartime, but further, the whole idea of preservation of human life does not seem to apply within a war setting. Okay? That whole idea doesn't apply. So, if we stop here, if we were to stop here, and I'll stop perhaps in a moment for any questions, but if we were to stop here, we could walk out and say, okay, war is not pleasant, as someone once famously said, war is hell, and that's what goes on during a war, and there is risk to life, and there are murders going on, and that's just part and parcel of the nature of war. The Torah says there is an idea called war, murder is permitted, danger to life is not an issue, just go do whatever you want. Whatever it takes to win that war, you could do it, and don't worry about it, if we were to stop there. Okay? And now I'll stop a moment for any questions before I move on.
So murder is allowed to be committed, or is it killing is allowed to be committed?
Yeah, I think you're
switching. I'm switching two terms. Killing, I should say. Okay, you are correct. Thank you, yes, okay. I'm mixing up my my terms over there. Killing is permitted, yes.
Just remember the rabbi speaks in Hebrew all the time.
There are actually two terms in Hebrew. One for murder. Murder would be called ritzicha in Hebrew. Okay, ritzicha would be murder, and killing would be hariga. Yeah, in Hebrew. Yeah, so you are correct. So he's right in the Hebrew as well. I'm down on both counts, but thank you. Okay. Okay. But let's see where this goes. In source number 5, I wrote over here a verse from when Saul went to wage war against the Amalekites. This is the famous battle that took place where Saul went to wage battle against the Amalekites, and God had told him there's to go to war against the nation of Amalek. And Saul does not quite carry out God's orders. He's taken to task for it, and God tells him, you're going to lose your kingdom because of this. Before he went down to attack the Amalekites, he sent a message to a group of people known as the Kenites. The Kenites are the descendants of Jethro, Moshe's father-in-law. Okay, and apparently these Kenites lived among the Amalekites. They lived in the same area. And Saul was concerned that when he goes to attack the Amalekites, the Kenites will be caught up in the battle. And he sent a message. What did he tell them? Go turn aside, go down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. So Saul gives a warning to the Kenites, get out, because we're coming to attack. This is not, if I'm properly informed, during a number of the battles that took place in Gaza, the Israeli army regularly rains down leaflets upon areas that they're planning on bombing, telling the civilians in that area, get out, because we're bombing soon. They have what I believe is called a knock. They will drop a dud missile on a home before they actually bomb it. I think they call it a knock or something like that, to let people know this house is slated for destruction in the very near future. Please get out. Okay. Again, difficult situations, but they will take steps, what they can, to warn people to get out. And here Saul does this to the Canaanites. But what is pointed out is that what Saul was telling the people was, get out, because if you don't, I make no guarantees for your safety. I'm going to war against this nation. You're part of that population. Your lives are in danger as well. And I cannot guarantee your safety during that period. And so here, many will quote this as a source that once the war begins, a civilian population that's not part of the battle necessarily may be, I don't want to use the term fair game, that's not a good term, but you know, their safety is not guaranteed by any stretch of the imagination, even though they're civilians. They're there. They're in that area, and once the war begins, part of war involves killing, and the killing is of whomever is in that area. Okay, another source, a similar source, in source number 6. This is King David speaking and saying, the word of God came to me saying, you have shed blood abundantly, and have made great wars. You shall not build a house to my name, because you have shed much blood upon the earth before me. King David wanted to construct the temple, and God told King David, you are not the man who will construct the temple, because you have shed much blood upon the earth. And one who has shed much blood cannot be the one to construct the temple. His son, King Solomon, is the one who constructed the temple. But it sounds almost as if God is criticizing King David for having gone to war. Okay, and generally, we don't find King David criticized for warring against Israel's enemies, against the enemies of the Jewish people, the Philistines, the Ammonites, the Moabites, whoever was causing them problems during different eras of his reign or the years before. He warred against them, and he is not taken to task for that. And suddenly God says, sorry, you shed too much blood, so you can't build a temple. Is this a criticism of King David? So the Radak, that's an acronym for Rabbi David Kimchi, who was a medieval commentator on the books of the prophets, he says the following. He says, the blood of the Gentiles that he shed, of the surrounding nations, even those who were not among those who were warring with him, meaning civilians, okay, that's the problem. That's what God is bothered by. The fact that King David killed people who were not combatants in the war, and he shed their blood as well during the course of the war, that's where the problem arose. The fact that he went to war and killed soldiers, enemy soldiers, that's not a problem, says the Radak, because that's part of the war. But the fact that he inevitably killed non-combatant civilians who were caught up in the battle, that is what invalidated him to build the temple. However, he was not punished for it. King David got punished for certain misdeeds that he committed, but he is not punished for this. Why? His intent was to destroy the wicked, that they not burst forth among the Jewish nation. In other words, King David was not trying to kill innocent civilians. He was trying to kill those who were causing problems for the Jewish nation, who were attacking them, who were marauding, invading the lands that the Jewish people were living in the land of Israel, and so on. But because inevitably some civilians got caught up, he's not punished for it. It wasn't his intent. He wasn't trying to kill them. But nonetheless, that invalidated him because he shed blood of non non-combatants, he could not build a temple. And here really you see the balance. It's not an ideal situation. So much so that God tells King David, you were justified in going to war against the enemies of the people of Israel, but you inevitably killed people who should not have been killed, and therefore you can't build a temple. But he's not punished for it because that's just the nature of war. So you have this kind of balance where King David has said, you're not the ideal person, but nonetheless, that's how it goes. So you're not going to be punished for it. And this is, again, the idea of the balance over here, that war involves this, and it's part and parcel of it, but we try to, but it's best avoided. It's not an ideal situation. That brings us to source number 7. And this really is a very strong statement. This is made by the Maharal, the famed Maharal of Prague, Rabbi Yehuda Lowy, and he says the following. All the wars that are found in the Torah, even though there were many who did not do anything, meaning there are civilians among those whom the Jewish people fought against, who were not engaged in attacking them, it makes no difference. For since they are part of the nation that committed evil against them, they are permitted to come against them in war, and this is true for all wars. So the Maharal here makes a very bold statement. This is a very controversial statement. Yeah, as you can see. And that is that if two nations are at war, and he makes this point very clear, that once you have two nations, and this is where the question of terrorists comes in, do a handful of terrorists, is that called that the nation went to war? So yes, if the United States declares war, okay, that means the nation is at war. Now, you may go and burn your draft card, but you're still part of that nation. If you want to move to Canada, that's a different story. But if you're still living in the United States, okay, and you're still getting college loans, even though you're burning your draft card and protesting against it and so on, but you're part of that nation, says the Maharal, when two nations are warring against each other, then everyone in that nation is, in a sense, fair game. Again, he's not necessarily giving a carte blanche. Now, there's a lot of debate and controversy around this Maharal, how to apply it, and so on and so forth. There are other sources who, in the context that he's discussing, don't say what he says, okay? And therefore, later authorities debate, the Maharal was during the 17th century, okay? And he's discussing a specific incident, and other authorities don't take his approach. And so later authorities say, well, the fact that other authorities didn't take his approach, that would indicate they don't agree at all. But many others say, well, the Maharal is kind of making a very broad statement over here. Everyone is fair game. You can kill everyone if you want. And so they would say that perhaps the other authorities don't agree with the broadness of that statement. You can't just go wipe out the entire nation. But they would agree in principle that when two nations are at war, the entire nation is at war. And so if the battle, if the need of the war will involve civilian casualties, the other authorities may well agree with the Maharal that the nature of war is there are two nations fighting with each other. Yes, soldiers may have, combatants may have a different status as lawful combatants, but in a sense, all members of that nation are at war as well. And when it's necessary, they may need to, you know, the military of one side may need to engage in activity which will pose a risk to life and limb of civilians, okay, in order to win the war. The classic case, the classic question of dropping the bomb on Japan, on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, was that justified? Was not justified? We can debate this. It's been debated. It will be debated. It has been debated. We hope not to have to debate it again anytime in the near future. Okay. Unfortunately, it has come up in recent weeks. But the idea behind it is Japan's at war with the United States. For the United States to invade Japan would lead to massive loss of life on the United States side, probably on the Japanese side. This seemed to be, to many military experts, and apparently to President Truman at the time, this is the best way to win the war and to minimize casualties. Go ahead and do it. This Maharal certainly would seem to give license to that approach. Civilian casualties? Yeah, but what's the other side of it? And since Japan's at war, all of Japan now becomes engaged in that war. And the fact that civilians are caught up in it, tragic, unfortunate, but that's the nature of war. Everyone's part of this as combatants, even as non-combatants, and when the need arises, and again, you talk about very careful judgment of is it necessary, is it not necessary, can we avoid it? Yes, those are the nuances, those are the details, case-by-case basis. But in a general overarching sense, the idea that the entire nation is at war, and therefore the entire nation may be at risk for loss of life and limb, is the message the Maharal is putting forth over here. Okay? Yes. Yeah. Okay. The flip side of this, and I will try to finish up quickly here, as Rabbi Schwab says, I'm running out of time, as always. When Jacob came to confront Esau, so the Torah says that Jacob was very distressed. And why was he distressed? Rashi says, lest he kill others. Now, the Maral, again, in a different piece, says, what do you mean, lest he kill others? Esau's coming to kill him with an army. So he says, even though they came to kill him, and we say the one who comes to kill you, kill him first, perhaps they did not really come to kill Jacob. Ah, even though Esau brought them with him, they possibly came out of fear, but they did not come to kill. In other words, they may have been kowtowed into joining this army, but not really interested in being there. They're being dragged off to Vietnam, so to speak, and they don't want to be there. They don't want to be part of this. Jacob, who did not know if they came to kill or not, was fearful lest he kill them. And again, here you have this balance. On the one hand, Jacob says, I have to go to battle. I have no choice. I got to defend myself. But he is very much distressed by the fact of the prospect that he may kill an innocent person who really doesn't want to be there. And he's dressed as a soldier. He doesn't want to be there. So again, you have this balance of, yes, it's wartime. Yes, it's not pleasant. But on the flip side, whatever can be done to mitigate those casualties should be, steps should be taken. And it's most clearly expressed by the Ramban, the great 13th century commentator, who says, we were commanded when laying siege to a city, this is a mitzvah in the Torah, says the Ramban, to leave one side without a siege, so that if the residents wish to run away, they have a path upon which to flee. From this we will learn to conduct ourselves with compassion, even with our enemies during wartime. Okay? So he lays it down very clearly. It's war. People die. People are going to be killed. But don't forget your compassion. This is not, you know, don't be cruel and don't look to kill. You have to leave an opening and do what you can to mitigate the damage. Okay? And that's really that whole discussion. The last source over here is really a totally separate discussion that I'm out of time. I will just leave you very quickly with this question. You can think about it. The law of the land is law. There's a Geneva Convention. Okay? Is an army, according to Torah law, obligated to abide by that Geneva Convention? Let's just say that they haven't even signed it.
No.
Okay? They're not. You're saying legally. Okay? I'm saying, let's say, from a Torah standpoint, would they be obligated to abide by it if they said, we're not interested? So here we come into a question of the law of the land is law. Now, normally the law of the land is law. If you're living in a country, in an area, you have to abide by the laws of that land. Does that idea apply internationally as well? You have a world global community. If most of the world has decided to adopt these laws, do you have to go with the majority as well? There's a big discussion whether law of the land is law applies internationally as well or just nationally. And I'll let you think about that. It depends. You have to figure out what the halachic basis of following the laws of the land is. If it's based on mutual agreement, then you may well be required to follow those agreements. Okay? If it's just based on the fact that, well, if you want to live here, you got to follow the laws, well, I'm not interested in living in The Hague or Geneva or wherever those agreements were signed, then you may well be allowed to thumb your nose at it. Okay, any questions? I'm sorry, I know my time is up, so I do apologize, but if there are any questions, I'm happy to take them now or after the class. But thank you all for coming. Thank you again to Captain Stitzer. And thank you all for coming. I wish you all a Sivach Sinatova, Shana Tova. And we'll see you next year.
Thank you.
Okay.
I know. Well, this is the whole reactor thing.